Good morning. I was wondering that Alfred Hitchcock saying, good evening, good morning. But that predates a lot of you, apparently. Okay, fine. Yeah. Who? Oh, gosh, I'm getting old. Last week, we were talking about being vulnerable and fearless at the same time. And that's another juxtaposition, another paradox that I just haven't been able to get out of my head this week. And so I kind of wanted to pick up right there because it really comes down to that. When Jesus talks about kingdom, what he's talking about is exactly this, the ability to be vulnerable. By that we mean unprotected, open, transparent, guard down, shields down, ability to really be present to another person, take everything in, unfiltered, just completely everything down, vulnerable, unprotected, and fearless at the same time. And here's the problem. When we get really vulnerable, which we normally think of as a negative thing, we get fearful. And when we're fearless, it's usually because we're really well defended, right? That's where the fearlessness comes from. We feel like we have some control. We feel like we have some protection. And so to be vulnerable and fearless at the same time is this crunch, this paradox, this thing that is so difficult for us to deal with. And yet, without it, we don't get anywhere. Nowhere close to kingdom that Jesus is talking about. And that's the key. In our experience, the closest thing that we can see to the perfection of vulnerability and fearlessness is a child. A child is completely vulnerable. Really doesn't even realize how vulnerable it is, right? But at the same time, fearless because it just trusts that mom and dad are going to have pancakes every Saturday morning. You know, they're a never-ending supply of pancakes. Of course, until that first cut comes and then everything starts to roll into human nature after that. But that's why Jesus holds up the child as the quintessential example of what kingdom looks like. And the whole key comes down to trust. To take the risk, to be open, to be vulnerable to the present moment, to what's in the moment, whatever it happens to be, even if it's painful, to still be open to it. To let that wash over you as well, because it's in that place, in that here now, that we have the only opportunity to connect with our God, who is the escape and the way through, who is the source of the healing and the restoration and the deliverance that we seek. Experience that enough times, and then we start to realize that's who this God is. We can afford to take the risk to be vulnerable, to be open, to be unprotected, because God is there. He is the floor underneath our feet. But see, we're so not good at paradox. Paradox just doesn't compute with our Western minds, our modern minds. We want to just have it all nailed down. And so this is something that we're going to have to deal with. Marion and I were flipping the channels, and we came across a movie called Predestination. And I don't know if any of you have seen this. It's actually built, it's based on, almost verbatim, a short story by Robert Heinlein. And for any of you science fiction buffs, he is like, you know, one of the science fiction gods. He and Asimov and Clark, those three. And he wrote this in 1959, and it involves time travel. And so in the future, time travel is possible. There are these temporal agents who come back to try to stop crimes that are known in the future before they start. And in the process of doing this, he's tending a bar, that's his cover, and a man walks in the bar, sounds like the start of one of Lisa's jokes, man walks in a bar, sits down, starts talking to our temporal agent, the barkeep, and he says, you know, I've got this crazy story of my life. Barkeep says, I've heard it all. He says, I'll bet you a bottle of your best stuff that my story tops everything. And so they make the bet, and he starts telling the story. And he starts out by saying, when I was a little girl, and wait a minute, what's going on? All right. So actually, he was born a girl. He was left on the doorstep of an orphanage, he says, by some strange person. Grew up in the orphanage. Getting out into the world, was met some mysterious man, had an affair with him, became impregnated. And then the man immediately leaves. She has the child. And due to medical complications, the doctors have to do a sex change operation on her. I know, it's getting weird. There's a point to this, I promise, at the end of all of this. Now he says, okay, well, I'm going to live with it, but I'm going to raise this child. Another mysterious man comes and takes the child away, never to be seen again, you know, hence the embittered person who's sitting there in the bar. The key to this whole thing is that as the agent is going through trying to stop this mad bomber that is his mission, he realizes he was the one who inadvertently had the affair with the young woman and fathered the child. He was the one who took the child away after the sex change happened and put this child in the orphanage. And he is all the characters in the movie at different times along this timeline. He is his own father and his own mother. He is the baby. And I just blew Steve's mind. Thank you. That's exactly the point. See, this is what's called a temporal paradox or a predestination paradox. You can't resolve it. How does this work? How is this possible? How could he be all those things? It becomes a chicken and the egg thing, you know, which came first and all of that. You know, and we, our minds, we want to try to figure this out. We want to try to resolve it. It says, well, that's just not possible. Well, of course, time travel, you know. But once you accept the premise of time travel, what do you do with the rest of this stuff? Is this possible? You see, the thing is that we look at these things in a linear fashion. We Westerners want to see everything lined out. We want to see the assumption. We want to see the premise. We want to see it leading inexorably to one and only conclusion because only one thing can be true at a time, you know, Western logic and all this sort of stuff. But what if time doesn't work that way? What if time is all just one thing? What if all of time is really just a mathematical singularity? And the beginning, the end, and everything that happens has already happened and has always happened. Then what happens? See, the thing is, if you start thinking along those lines, you can see how maybe something that you can't even quite get to is possible in a way that you never really could imagine before, but still you can't work it out. And the more you try to work it out, now you're back on the linear time frame again. But to pull back out and just see everything as a unity changes the perspective. Now, you don't even need time travel to have these predestination paradoxes, as they're called. You know the ancient story of Oedipus? You probably all heard of an Oedipal complex where a young boy is fixated with his mother. Well, that comes from the legend of Oedipus. And Oedipus was born to King Laius and his queen, but a prophecy was told to the king that his son would kill him and marry his mother. Totally freaked out, he takes the boy and abandons him in the woods. A kindly couple finds him and raises him as their own. Years later, Oedipus hears that same prophecy, and for fear of killing his now adopted father and marrying his mother, because he doesn't know he's adopted, he flees and goes into the countryside, meets a man there, kills him. Out of pity, marries his widow. Guess what? It's his father and his mother. And so the very action that was taken to avoid the outcome is what put the time frame in motion. The Bible has these same predestination paradoxes. Remember the story of Joseph? Joseph has a series of dreams. In one of them, he sees 11 sheaves of corn all bowing down to his sheaf of corn. In another dream, he sees 11 stars bowing down to his star. And he tells this to his brothers unadvisedly, and they are outraged that he would have the chutzpah to say that they were going to bow down to him. And so partially just in their fury and partially in their willingness, wanting to avoid this situation, they take him, they abduct him, and they sell him into slavery, where he ends up in Egypt and through a series of crazy events becomes the viceroy of Egypt, the second in command. And when there's a famine in Canaan, the brothers have to go to beg for food and are actually bowing down in front of their brother, unbeknownst to them. The very action that they took is what caused all this to go into place. The Bible is full of paradox. The Bible is full of language that is paradoxical, language that is ambiguous, language that can't be resolved. And in that way, it mimics life, because life is exactly the same way. For all of the energy and effort we put into trying to control things, trying to figure them out, trying to make them fit into the neat boxes that we want them to fit in so that we can have a bit of security in life. When does it ever work out that way? When have you planned a conversation that worked out the way that you wanted it to work out? When have you planned most anything that works out the way you want it to work out? These things are so difficult. Life is unresolvable. It just keeps cycling through, moving through. And so we can't control life this way. And it makes us completely fearful. It terrifies us that life is outside our control. But when we look at the Bible is giving us the same scenario. It's not giving us answers that we can hold on to, answers that we can use to lock things down and make this ours. You know, that whole idea of the Bible as the owner's manual to life is just not cutting it. Because you can't just go down the outline, the executive summary, and hit all the points and get it right. Life is too clearly ambiguous for that, too paradoxical for that, too unresolved for that. You know? Look what happened to Job. Think about the story of Job. All that this happens to Job, and he cries out to God in the whirlwind. And what's the answer that he ultimately gets? Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you when I put the stars in the place in the firmament? In other words, I'm God, you're not. Get over it. Even if I could tell you, you couldn't understand. These temporal paradoxes are unresolvable in your mind, in this life, right here and right now. Let it be. Moses, on Mount Sinai, about to get the tablets of the law. God, show me your glory. What's he actually asking for? Show me your face. I want to see your face. God says, you can't see my face and live. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to pass by right here. So you, I'm going to put in the cleft of this rock, and I'm going to hold my hand over you as I pass by. And when I'm good and gone, then I'm going to release my hand so you can see the trailing clouds of glory. But you can't see my face. We want that clarity. We want that exactitude. We want to see God's face. Thomas tells his disciples, I'm not going to believe until I stick my hands in the wounds. This is post-resurrection. And Jesus comes and shows him. My Lord and my God, he says. But Jesus says, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Blessed are those who can start to live life with the unknown, with the unresolved. Blessed are those who are able to live with the paradoxes of life, the ambiguities of life. Because this is exactly what the Bible is teaching us. This is exactly what Jesus is teaching us. You want to find your life, you got to lose it. If you want to sit at the head of the table, you got to sit at the foot. And if you want to be Lord of all, then you got to be everyone's servant. Paradox, ambiguity, unresolved nature of things. Everything that we try to hold on to evaporates if we just allow ourselves to be. That's Psalm 46. We have a little bit of it right here. Be still and know that I am God. And last week or a couple of weeks ago, we had that reduction. Remember? Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be. Can we do that? Can we stop trying to figure things out long enough? Can we stop trying to control things, put them in categories and boxes long enough to just be? Because when that happens, we start to know something. So what is it that we get to know? We've talked about this here before, but it's so important to keep coming back to these principles because our culture and our society and our lives keep moving us back into familiar spaces. But to know to a Jew, yada, which is the word for hand, means to be able to handle something, not understand it intellectually, but to have intimate experience with it. This person, this thing. And so when Jesus talks in Matthew 7 about people who say, Lord, Lord, let us into the kingdom. And he says, I can't because I never knew you. But we did all these great things. You know, we built 24/7 satellite networks in your name. But I never knew you. See, we mistake all the work that we do toward an outcome. We mistake building all these things that we think have all these worthy attributes and worthy consequences to people for just the being in intimate relationship with God. Now, in that passage at Matthew 7, it sounds like Jesus is saying, depart from me. Well, that's what it says. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. I never knew you. But what's really going on there? What's really happening is Jesus is saying, we never had the kind of relationship that allowed you to see me as I really am in this moment right now. You keep walking right past me to go work on your satellite network, and you're so busy over there that you don't realize that I'm there too, with you all the time. But you never have been able to just be so that we can connect. And this idea of knowing goes way deeper than that in Jewish thought. And this is where I always get into trouble, because it's a euphemism for sexual intercourse. Now, first time I read that, first time I studied that and figured that out, I got so excited. It's like, wow, it just opened up this big vista for me. And so the next time I had a chance to preach at the church where I was associate pastor, I blurt this stuff out. And my poor wife is crawling under the chair. I said, if you want to know God, you got to take him into your tent and you got to know him. You know, like Adam knew Eve and bore a son. It's taking him in and having that kind of intimacy, that kind of connection. But it's there. It's true. And maybe I got to work that through a little bit better and make sure that I have speaking to the right group who can handle such things. But that's the kind of knowing. I wanted to read just a little passage from Richard Rohr's book that we're reading on Wednesday, because he hits this right dead on. He writes, when we go into God's presence, we find someone not against us, but someone who is definitely for us. The saints report, someone else is holding me. Someone is believing in me. That's what people who pray always say. Someone is for me more than I am for myself. Someone is with me more than I am with myself. Meister Eckhart, the medieval Dominican mystic, says, God is closer to me than I am to myself. The great ones are always in agreement. The mystical Jews and Christians, at that level, the language is always the same. God is a lover. Prayer is being loved at a deep, sweet level. I hope you have felt such intimacy alone with God. I promise you it is available to you. Maybe a lot of us just need to be told that it is what we should expect and seek. We're afraid to ask for it. We're afraid to seek. It feels presumptuous. We can't trust that such a love really exists, but it does. Often the imagery becomes sexual because it is the only adequate language to describe this contemplative experience. I've often wondered why God would give his creatures such a strong and constant fascination with one another's image, form, and face. Why would God take such a risk unless it were an important risk? What is the connection between our human passion and knowing God? Are all relationships a school of communion? These are the truly religious questions that we must dare to ask. You see, we're too fearful to be vulnerable. We're too fearful to really fall in love. We're too fearful to just be that unprotected and open to God or to anyone. We really want our cake and we want to eat it too. We want to be protected. We want to have our shields up. We want to feel secure. We want to feel in control. And yet we want intimate relationship too. You know, it doesn't work that way. As long as you are defended, as long as you are protected, you are alone in your fortress, in your prison of your own making. To break free from that, to break through all that, and still remain fearful is really what this kingdom is all about, what Jesus is trying to tell us is all about. The Jews understood this doesn't work, you know. And they weren't embarrassed at all about their sexuality. They were really open about it. They're a really earthy people. Have you really read the Old Testament? Have you read how much sex is in the Old Testament? I mean, come on. There is adultery, David and Bathsheba. There is rape. There is fornication. There is stuff going on all over the place. And the beautiful thing about the Jews is they didn't shrink away from putting that in their book. Maybe beautiful from our point of view because it's not something we would do. We'd be covering all that stuff up. We still have this Puritan ethic that goes all the way back to the founding of this country that has taken sexuality and put it into this different place in life, as if there's something wrong with it, as if there's something less than it, and then hiding it. This idea that in order to be more spiritual, we have to be less physical. We have to, you know, take out all the pleasures of life in order to be closer to Christ. Nothing could be further from a Jewish mentality than all of that. They just laid it all out there. For them to be closer to God was to be closer to life, to lean into life, to lean into the moments, to just let go with all of that. Now, of course, you stayed within the law, you stayed within the bounds of marriage, and these things that I'm talking about are outside of that. But there wasn't anything that they were embarrassed about. And they absolutely connected that type of intimate relationship between a husband and wife as the one that they saw between them individually and as a nation and their God. And the one thing that I wanted to jump into right now is the Song of Songs. Because this book is a really unique book in the Bible. I have a little bit excerpted in the bulletins. But it's been a difficult book for the church. It was a difficult book for even for the Jews. Because it doesn't mention God's name. It doesn't mention the covenant. It doesn't mention the law. It doesn't mention any of those things that normally a book of the Bible would. And it wasn't until the second century that the rabbis finally decided that, yes, this book was canonical. And it was because they could trace it back to Solomon's authorship. And it's because they then allegorized the relationship between the man and the woman as between the relationship between God and the nation of Israel. In other words, this was depicting God's love for Israel. And the Christians followed suit, had the book in their canon from the earliest possible years, but understood again, allegorically, as Christ's love for the church. You know? But this idea of the sexuality rested very uneasy, especially with the Christian church. And fast forwarding 1,000 years into the medieval era, it was really difficult for them to square these things. And so everything had to be very spiritualized, very allegoricalized, if you will. And one of the commentators that I ran across as I was prepping was talking about how all of this allegory, and it really got fantastic. At a certain point, the church was saying, okay, well, this is really not even about Christ's love for the church, but it's God's love for the Virgin Mary, all right? Or it's the acting out, the describing out of Jesus' marriage, quote-unquote, to his human nature. In his incarnation, he actually married, you know, into the flesh of humanity. And so they're seeing that working out. So allegories and the metaphors are flying all over the place. And he's saying, you know what? We need to pull back a little bit and take this a little more literally. But listen to what he writes, because this is fascinating. He says, it's much better, therefore, if this book is explained or illustrated at all, to take it in its literal meaning, to explain it in its general sense. Now, I say general sense because there are many passages in which it should not be explained if taken literally, the references being too delicate. An Eastern phraseology on such subjects is too vivid for European imaginations. In other words, don't go to the erotic parts. Let any sensible and pious medical man read over this book, and if at all acquainted with Asiatic phraseology, say whether it would be proper, even in medical language, to explain all the descriptions and allusions in this poem. It's a love poem. Let's read a little bit of it. Right at the beginning, Songs 1:1. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Now, as you read through this, what you're going to see is the dialogue is going to be shifting between the man and the woman. It starts with the woman. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore, the maidens love you. Draw me after you and let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will rejoice in you and be glad. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. I am black, but lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon, do not stare at me because I am swarthy or dark-skinned, for the sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard. And what she's saying there metaphorically is that in the work that she does out in the sun, she hasn't cared after her own complexion and kept it lighter. To me, my darling, this is he speaking, you are like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of beads. We will make for you ornaments of gold and beads of silver. than she. While the king was at his table, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh which lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. How beautiful are you, he says, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. She says, how handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. Indeed, our couch is luxuriant. The beams of our house are cedars, our rafters cypresses. In other words, they're in the forest. I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. He, like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. In his shade I took great delight and sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He has brought me to this banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. Sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, because I am lovesick. Let his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embrace me. And then he finally says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. There's something about this that is just so human. I mean, there's some of the language that sounds archaic. Other language just brings us right back into the moment. That idea of my hand under her head and the other hand embracing and don't wake her up until she pleases. I mean, these things could be written yesterday. These things are so familiar to us in our lives and the way that we relate to each other. I love the way that human beings don't change. That ancient literature is just as accessible to us in these intimacies as our everyday lives are, you know. And we get hung up on this idea of the literal sense, you know, the love nature of this poem, the sexuality. And then we alternately get hung up on the allegorical nature of the spirituality of the whole thing. Is it God and Israel? Is it Christ and the church? Is it God and Mary and Jesus and his nature? I mean, what's going on here? And we try to categorize it, and we try to put it into place. I read just a little paragraph here of one such commentator who says, there is widespread consensus that although the book has no plot, it does have what can be called a framework, as indicated by the links between its beginning and end. Beyond this, however, there appears to be little agreement. Attempts to find a chiastic structure have not been compelling, and attempts to analyze it into units use differing methods and arrived at differing results. And oh my God, we've just killed the whole thing. It's a love poem. Look what they're trying to do to it. Isn't that just like us? To try to take something that is ambiguous. It's evocative. It's just trying to show us the feelings that are being experienced. And we want to put them into these little places. The Old Testament tells us that Solomon took an Egyptian wife, the daughter of Pharaoh. Egyptians are darker skinned than the Jews. Couldn't it just be a love poem? Couldn't it just be trying to get across in words what it feels like to be that in love? To be that in love with life? To be that open? You know, what if this book is nothing more than that? Does it deserve to be in the Bible? Because it doesn't speak of God? Is there something there that can defend it? Make it appropriate? A little bit more. And just listen, because I know, unless he can put it up on the screen, that song at the second chapter, verse 8. Listen, my beloved. Behold, he is coming, climbing on the mountains, leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice. My beloved responded and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past, and the rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared in the land. The time has arrived for pruning the vines, and the voices of the turtle dove have been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its figs, and the vines in blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. O my dove in the cleft of the rock, in the secret place of the steep pathway, let me see your form, let me hear your voice. For your voice is sweet and your form is lovely. Catch the foxes with us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while their vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies. until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. Turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bethair. What happens when we fall in love? We become vulnerable and fearless, don't we? We've finally found something worth dying for, and so we've finally found something worth living for. And it changes the nature of everything. Everything becomes brand new, doesn't it? Can you remember a time when you felt that way? And even the things you'd seen a million times had something new about them. In other words, we become like children again. So excited, running everywhere, pointing at everything. You know? Look at the details here in this passage I just read. The winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers have already appeared. The time has arrived for pruning the vines. You know? Catch the foxes for us. They're ruining the vineyards while they're in blossom. All these tiny little details. The person who wrote this is completely aware, completely present, completely open to everything. I think we get fixated on the wrong things in this book. It's not so much about being in love. It's not so much about sexuality. What it really is about is presence. It's being so immediately present that everything, every sensation, every detail is just rocketing into your consciousness. And to be able to capture that, to put that down, that kind of connection, that kind of intimacy, that kind of celebration of all of nature and your specific relationships is kingdom. That's what Jesus is trying to get across to us. What makes us feel alive this way? What makes us tune in this way? Is it being in love? Is that what it is? I suppose that's why we're always running from lover to lover, aren't we? Always trying to find the next relationship so we can feel that feeling again. But when we do that, we just become like an addict with a drug. We're looking for the next fix and the next fix. The truth of the matter is you can't stay in love at that kind of intensity. It just won't last. We can't do it as human beings. We oscillate. We're all over the place. And so when it's gone, we think there's something wrong and we want to find it again. But the truth of the matter is what being in love does to us is make us present, makes us vulnerable, makes us fearless. And it's the vulnerability and the fearlessness that makes us feel alive, that connects us to our world, to our moments, in a way that allows us to fall in love. There's the paradox. Chicken and the egg. Which came first? I don't know. When you're in it, who cares? And if you do care where you're in it, then you just killed it. Now you're not experiencing it anymore. You're thinking about it. You're trying to put it into categories again. Just let it be. Flow. Let it go. Let it go. This is what Jesus was trying to get across. This in-loveness of vulnerability and fearlessness. Jesus calls us to prayer of a special type because he's trying to get us to start to learn how this works in our lives. He says, when you pray, don't do it out in the middle of things. Don't do it where all the people are. Retreat into your closet. And this is both spiritual and it's physical at the same time. He talks about clearing a space. The Lord's Prayer, properly understood. The first line, our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. That hallowing, that holiness is clearing a space. Clearing a space for the actual essence of the character of God, his name, to take residence in us. It's a leaning in. It's an attentiveness. It's presence. Jesus is telling us, this is what you can do. You can retreat into this inner space that you clear, and something starts to happen. And you can also clear an external space as well. Jesus is depicted as going into the mountains or going into the wilderness at intervals, away from the crowds, even away from his disciples to pray. All night, for days on end, trying to find that center again, reconnect. Because he was getting what? Burned out a little bit? Overwhelmed with all the details and all the needs? And he goes out and clears that interior space and clears an exterior space. Maybe he needs the exterior space to clear the interior space, or vice versa. Chicken and egg, paradox, which comes first? Doesn't really matter. Does it just start somewhere? Retreat into your physical space that is cleared so that you can clear the interior space. And when you get really good at clearing the interior space, then you can clear it anywhere, wherever things are going. And Jesus calls us to go and do exactly that. As we take our prayer out into each moment of our lives, the seamless prayer that Paul talks about, it's a call to this mindfulness. It's a call to this presence where we notice all these details, even the smallest ones. What did Jesus say? Look at the birds. Look at the flowers. Look at the lilies. You know, the birds don't work. The flowers don't spin. And yet, look at all that happens. Calling attention to the simplest, most ubiquitous details of everyday life is something Jesus was always doing. There's one story where he's in the temple courtyard and he notices a widow coming in, elderly widow, drops two mites, about the smallest amount of money that she could drop into the collection basket. After all of these rich people were coming in and dumping in large amounts, she comes in. A widow, a woman in that culture was invisible. No one would notice them. No one would comment on them. And no one would think that there was anything significant about what she put into the collection box, except Jesus. He notices things that other people miss. And he calls attention. He is attentive. He is there. And he draws the lessons of life from all of these little things that happen. He does the same thing with children. Children were invisible in that society. And yet Jesus never misses an opportunity to play with them, to call them to himself, to spend time with them, because they are precious. They are the embodiment of kingdom as far as he is concerned. Presence, noticing details, to be vulnerable, unprotected, is to be able to see all these details in the moment, to become alive in the moment, to become in love in the moment. You know, you do that enough, you experience the Father's presence in all these moments enough, and you start to become fearless because you understand this Father that we say that we're following, this Father that we say that we want to be with, when we actually do clear the space and fall into that place, that we realize he is okayness. He is that sense of peace. He is that sense that somehow all of this is going to work out. And we realize there isn't a risk to being vulnerable and open and giving ourselves away, because our Father is always there to catch us and to bring us through those moments. And the lifestyle starts to take shape. It starts to get steam behind it. It starts to reinforce itself as we go. Practice presence. That's what Jesus is saying. When he says, seek first the kingdom and God's righteousness, and all else will be added, what is he literally saying? God's righteousness is unity, connection, which only occurs with vulnerability. And kingdom is the awareness and the experience of that unity and oneness in fearless, fearless connection. Seek that and everything else will be added. This is what Jesus is trying to talk to us about. We need to do this. How many details do you miss on a drive to and from work, to and from church? How many details do you miss when you just go out on break? How many opportunities are there for you to lock in, to find something that locks you into this moment and just turns it on? It's like a light goes on in the moment and you see things so clearly and all of the senses are activated. I was talking to someone who was going out to smoke a cigarette, and I said, you know, when you go to smoke that cigarette, really smoke the cigarette. Feel it. Feel that suction on it. Feel the smoke going into your lungs and just feel it. It's a sensual experience. Really feel it. And she looked at me and said, I've never heard any pastor talk like you. But if you're going to do it, really do it. Of course, now, really being one with the sensation of all that smoke going in your lungs, maybe that'll be your impetus to want to not do that anymore. How about that? And then when you don't smoke the cigarette, really don't smoke the cigarette. Whatever you do, really do it. I was leaving here the other day, and man, I got all twisted. There were so many things, and I forgot to do this, and I forgot to do that. And I was screaming around the courtyard here, and I had to mail some letters, and I had forgotten stamps. I had to come back, get stamps, and all this stuff is going on. I finally get out to the mailbox, and I'm just about to put them in, and I happen to look up, and the clouds were just insane. I'd never seen clouds like this before. I don't know how they get that way. They were like these little wispy strips. They looked like sails of some sort of skeleton ship, kind of scalloped all across the sky. And I had polarized sunglasses on, you know, which makes all the detail and the contrast just pop. So then I was taking them off and putting them on and look how they... And then I was doing this. I was turning my head because it changes, you know, the polar... I must have looked like an idiot. I was sitting there just looking at the sky with holding this mail in my hand and looking at, you know... I turned into a little kid at that moment. And all the junk that I was so worried and preoccupied with, out the door. Just because I looked at the clouds. This stuff works. You know, it seems so insignificant. It seems so like nothing. But you just watch a column of ants walking across a courtyard carrying all the stuff that they carry, and you actually notice them and see them, and you enter into that experience. Because a little bit of nature that actually happens in South Orange County anymore, it's like, cool, I can see that, you know? Opened up the garage door, and there was a rabbit sitting right in my driveway, and it scampered off. It's like, wow, I actually can see a rabbit still in South Orange County. You know, can we revel in these things? Can you just take time to look up into these towering eucalyptus over here and see the way the wind blows them about and the way the sun reflects off each leaf? Can we just let it go. Fall into this place. See, it's about that presence that takes us into the intimacy that Jesus is talking about here. I wanted to end with one more thing. And if you would just take a quiet pose for a second. This is Walt Whitman. I don't know if any of you read Walt Whitman in school. But it's from his Leaves of Grass anthology of the Song of Myself. I just want to read a little bit of excerpt. Think about what we just said. Listen to what the poet says. I celebrate myself and sing myself. And what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same, and their parents the same. I now, 37 years old, in perfect health begin, hoping to cease not till death. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch and vine. My respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of the shore and dark-colored sea rocks, and of hay in the barn, the sound of belched words of my voice loosed to the eddies of the wind, a few light kisses, a few embraces, a reaching around of arms, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag, the delight alone or in the rush of the streets, or along the fields and hillsides, the feeling of health, the full noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun. I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end, but I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and never will there be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. Urge and urge and urge. Always the procreant urge of the world. Out of the dimness, opposite equals advance. Always substance and increase. Always a knit of identity. Always distinction. Always a breed of life. I am satisfied. I see, dance, laugh, sing. I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. Loaf with me on the grass. Loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best. Only the lull I like, the hum of your velvet voice. And I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own. And I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own. And that all men ever born are also my brothers, and the woman my sisters and lovers. And that a kelson of the creation is love. And limitless are leaves stiff or drooping in the fields. And brown ants in the little wells beneath them. And mossy scabs of the worm fence, heaped stones, elder, mullein, and pokeweed. A child said, "What is the grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name somewhere in the corners that we may see and remark and say, "Whose?" Or I guess the grass itself is a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. And now it seems to me the beautiful, uncut hair of graves. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women, and the hints about old men and mothers, and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows that there is really no death. And if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it, and ceased the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward. Nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. What does it mean? What does it mean to you? Something just out of reach? Something right on the tip of your tongue? Something that you've experienced? Something that you know but can't quite put into words? And he puts them into words. And through him we experience it again. Not understanding, but just that feeling of a beautiful, ambiguous, unresolved, paradoxical life that if we will just lay ourselves into, we will find the God that we seek. Because if we can learn to love poetry and art and music that speaks to us on this different level and this different language, just as the Bible does, then we can learn to live life with the same terms. We can become vulnerable and fearless and completely connected to our God. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your poets who wrote our scripture, who continue to write for us, who continue to show us the way of living this life. We need them. We need your voice that speaks through them. Help us to just enter in. Help us to see your creation as you see it, as you created it. Help us to be really, really present and aware of every moment. Help us to fall in love again with life and with all the little details of life, so that we can just be able to write our own poetry and connect. Father, we love you because you first loved us. Take us wherever you want us to go. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all